Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. In a moment, we'll speak with a reporter who's written a new book about how Donald Trump turned the presidency into a business. And later, we'll talk with one of the top environmental activists in the country about the environment under President Trump. First, five listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, most of the comments had to do with the election and also our replay of Florida this week. Here's what several people had to say.
On Monday's show, you were having a very good discussion about Donald Trump demanding that his attorney general, who functions more like a private lawyer than an attorney general, demands that his attorney general arrest Obama, Biden, and Clinton, as well as members of law enforcement, because of what happened in 2016. Now, first of all, this is right out of Putin's playbook. Mohammed bin Salman, Bolsonaro, Duterte, and other dictators that Trump has publicly palled around with and expressed his undying support for, especially when he said that him and Kim Jong-un fell in love. Those were his exact words. Now, all of these dictators that he admires, when they have political opponents, they arrest them, they exile them, or they kill them. Trump seems to be heading in that direction.
It's Mia from St. Petersburg. I'm 67. I'm a super voter. I'm a Democrat. And, of course, just like I've always done, request a mail-in ballot. I physically drop it off. In August, I dropped it off at the Largo Library, where there was actually an employee. Of course, it was early voting. An employee from the Supervisor of Elections office. Long story short, I'm beginning to get pop-ups on my computer saying, remember to mail your ballot. And I think, of course, I'm going to do that. I've done that forever. Drop it off. However, I read this small print. It's from the Republican Party. Anyway, they did send ballots out the 29th. I called 1 week later, still had not had a ballot. Didn't get one until just this past Wednesday. And then when I called requesting the second, I got the second ballot Saturday. All right, well, keep up the good work. It was a terrific show.
This is Robin Thanos-Hassan. You know, the Trump statement about arresting Obama, Biden, and Hillary Clinton, I think it's a desperate reaching out to that QAnon crowd, because that's like one of their big conspiracy theories. He's desperate for any votes he can get, and I think he was sort of appealing to that segment of his supporters. And in terms of all of this odd behavior, I've been thinking lately that here's a guy who felt supremely confident in his ability to present an image that would, you know, somehow carry the day. But he did that on a television show, which is a controlled environment. I think he overestimated his ability as a performer and manipulator of individuals. He has bitten off something way bigger than he can chew, and he doesn't understand politics is not like being on a television show. And I think that miscalculation is sort of making him look like a damn fool to the eyes of an increasingly larger number of people.
Trace in St. Pete. A woman, that Republican woman, I know you've had her on several times on the PBS show. All I can say is, for me, I wouldn't vote for a Republican woman, nor do I really trust any of them, of what they say, because for me, if a woman doesn't trust herself to make decisions about her own body, then how am I supposed to trust or believe what they say for president, say, the nuclear weapons or, you know? I just don't trust somebody who doesn't trust themselves not to make the right decisions about their own bodies.
Hi, I turned in late to Monday's show. Listening to some of the callers prompted me to remind all that presidents do not develop the cure or the vaccines for diseases. Scientists and healthcare professionals do. Our current president seems to want to take credit for just about everything.
Well, there you have some listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. First up today, President Trump did not sell his businesses when he took office, nor did he give them away. By holding on to his businesses, he launched an unprecedented experiment. What happens to a multi-billion dollar range of businesses when its leader ascends to the presidency of the U.S.? And more importantly, what happens to the country? We're going to talk with Dan Alexander, who just wrote a book called White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. Dan is a senior editor at Forbes, where he leads the magazine's coverage of Donald Trump. And twice a year, he's responsible for putting together Forbes' estimate of Donald Trump's net worth. Dan Alexander, welcome to WMNF. Thank you for coming on the program.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
When President Trump came into office, he did not sell his businesses. He didn't turn it over to a blind trust. What did the president do when he came to office? What did he do with his businesses?
So he made a series of promises. He said that he was going to hand over the management of the day-to-day operations to his kid, to Eric, and to Don Jr. He said that he was going to not do any new foreign deals. And he said a bunch of other things. And if you sort of go through those promises, some of them he may have partially kept. Others of them he did not. So he said he wasn't going to do any new foreign deals. He ends up in 2018 selling land in the Dominican Republic. He says that an outside ethics advisor is going to review all new deals in his business. And an attorney for the Trump Organization later told me that that was not happening. He said that he was not going to talk with his kids about the operations of the business. And Eric Trump, his son who's running the company now, told me, in his office in Trump Tower that he did plan to update his father on the financials of the business. So you sort of go through, the plan, and it all kind of fell apart. But certainly what did happen was he did delegate, a lot of the day-to-day stuff to the kids. And, which makes sense. If you're in your 70s and you have other interests or other things to do, in this case, plenty of them, then, it makes sense to hand off the keys to the kids and tell them to drive the car for a little while. And, one of the big questions is, how much did Trump actually step back from the management and the operations of the business? Not only is there, Eric Trump telling me that he planned to update his dad on the business, but, the New York Times just this weekend reported several instances in which Trump apparently was keeping his hand in the operations of the business, suggesting to Eric to fire a particular person at Doral, asking people, how the back patio was looking, whether it was full at Mar-a-Lago. Obviously, the fact that he's constantly going to his properties gives him a chance to check up on, how they're doing. It would be impossible not to look around and notice what's going on. But he's, he's not sitting there. I don't think anybody believes that he's sitting there, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and instead of handling the business of the country, is handling the business of his business. But nonetheless, he still does own it. And that's the important thing. The money's all his, and so therefore the potential conflicts and all of that come with him too.
Well, let's talk about those conflicts. In your reporting, did you find any instances where either companies or countries that had things that they wanted the Trump administration to deal with, whether or not they cozied up to the president by sending money towards one of his properties?
Yeah, it's virtually an endless list. I went through all of the commercial buildings and figured out who all the tenants are. And I found more than 150 different tenants, and altogether, those tenants pay about $177 million of annual rent. And if you go through the roster of those tenants and just kind of the, highlight numbers, so at least 35 of those tenants who are paying Trump rent actively have lobbied the federal government while Trump was in office. And at least 20 of them have lobbied Trump personally or the White House itself. And at least 30 tenants are federal government contractors, meaning the government is paying them money to handle various business that the government needs to be done. Many of those contracts are enormous. If you add up all of the money just from 2 years, while Trump's in office, you get to more than $8 billion in federal contracts flowing from the Trump administration to Trump's private tenants. Mm. 17 tenants, at least, were under federal investigation while they were paying the President of the United States large sums of money. And there were four foreign government entities that have rented space in Trump buildings. So from China, from Qatar, from India, and from the United Arab Emirates. You add all of that up, and remember, this is just a portion of his business. This is just the commercial real estate that we're talking about. You know, not to set aside the hotels and the golf and all of that for a second. Just the commercial real estate is where you find all of that. You know, that alone is the most tangled web of potential conflicts that the White House has ever seen.
Did that revenue increase from the time before the President Trump was president to afterwards? In other words, did the amount of money that was coming in from those entities in those countries, did that go up after President Trump came into office?
So there, if you look at the whole portfolio, you know, his revenue has stayed fairly consistent. What changes, though, are certain people want to pay him. Other people might not be interested in paying him anymore. And so it's not necessarily that this has all been great for his business. In fact, the presidency has been harmful to his business overall. But he has allowed lots of people to pay him who want to pay him. So you don't get the business positive, but you do get the political negative of hanging on to the business, of having all of the conflicts. You know, one example that really stands out is the Qatar Investment Authority. So, you know, Qatar is a U.S. ally based in the Middle East, of course, and they are feuding with their neighbors who are also U.S. allies. So the Saudis have accused the Qataris of funding terrorists. And Trump goes over to Saudi Arabia on his first trip overseas, and the Saudis explain to him their point of view, that they believe that the Qataris are funding terrorists. And Trump comes back to the United States convinced of this point of view and echoes it at the White House and says that Qatar is funding terrorists, which is a very big accusation to make against a U.S. ally. So the Qataris go into overdrive to try to basically salvage their reputation. You know, so they do deals buying airplanes from Boeing and buying missile systems from, you know, U.S. defense contractors. And they start lobbying a bunch in Washington. But one of the things that they do, which I uncovered in the book and it had remained a secret for, you know, more than a year, was they figured out how to lease space in Trump's most valuable building, which is a skyscraper in San Francisco, 555 California Street. And what was even stranger about this, and I went to the building to investigate all of this, because since it hadn't been out, I had to sort of see it with my own eyes to confirm that it was true. And when I went to the space, you know, I got up the elevator and the doors opened and I looked into this office, glass doors, you know, beautiful white couches, nice lattice work, Qatar Investment Authority on the wall behind the reception desk. But there were no receptionists there. There was no one walking the halls. There was nobody in the meeting rooms. There was no one in the office, period. Knocked on the door, nobody answered. Came back the next day at a different time, knocked on the door, nobody answered. And so you start connecting the dots here, and you've got a foreign country that really needs the President of the United States to change his mind on something. And that foreign country has started a new office lease for space in Donald Trump's most valuable building, and there doesn't seem to be any clear business purpose behind that office lease. There's no business going on there. And then you look at what happens with U.S. policy, and Trump, you know, invites the Emir of Qatar to Washington afterward, after they initiate this lease. And the Emir of Qatar is sitting in the White House Oval Office, and Trump turns to him, and now he says the exact opposite thing as he had said before. He says, "I want to thank you for all of the work that you've done fighting against terrorism funding." And so you have all of that stuff going on in this change in U.S. policy that's a total 180. And it leaves you wondering a question that we don't usually have to wonder about our elected officials, which is a foreign government, have they been able to change a U.S. leader's mind by paying him money? And we can't get inside Trump's head, so we don't know for sure what motivated this change. But the set of facts and circumstances certainly don't look good. It's exactly the sort of thing that the founding fathers were fearful of and that ethics experts were warning about at the start of the Trump administration.
Our guest is Dan Alexander. He's the author of the brand new book, White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. He's a senior editor at Forbes, where he leads the magazine's coverage of Donald Trump, and twice a year he's responsible for putting together Forbes' estimate of Donald Trump's net worth. I want to get to net worth in just a moment, but first of all, Qatar, our former attorney general from Florida, Pam Bondi, for the last few years has worked as a registered lobbyist for Qatar, and I'm just wondering, what do you know about that? Do you know anything about that?
Well, it doesn't surprise me much that, you know, she would be the sort of person that the Qataris would want to use to get close to the Trump administration. The Qataris are very aggressive in forming ties in ways that they think will benefit them, as we saw with the office lease, but it would make sense that they would want somebody in Trump's, not inner circle, but kind of second ring of circle, I guess, like Pam Bondi. Of course, there's a history that you and your listeners will know well between Pam Bondi and Donald Trump, and a donation that went to one of her campaigns while she was considering investigating one of his businesses. And since that moment, you know, she's sort of been a figure in Trump world. And but I don't know, you know, what exactly her relationship has been for the Qataris and, you know, who she's talked to in that capacity. But it certainly makes sense that they would, that would be the sort of person that they'd be interested in working for him.
Dan, you're there at Forbes, and one of your jobs is to make an estimate of President Trump's net worth. So what can you tell us right now about his net worth?
Well, right now he's worth an estimated $2.5 billion. His assets add up to $3.66 billion, last time I counted, and the debt is about $1.1 billion. Now, if you go through these assets, you know, Trump and other people, for various reasons, like to make it seem like this is an impossible exercise. Like, you can't figure out how rich the president is. And the truth is that, you know, at Forbes, we figure out how rich about 2,000 people are every single year. And Donald Trump is just a billionaire like the other 1,999. That's a rough number. It, you know, changes day to day how many billionaires there are in the world. But so we can go through the same process. And, you know, we just look at what the assets are. And you go asset by asset. And, you know, there's a lot of financial information, more than I think most people understand, that has to be disclosed by Trump's lenders. And so we have a very good idea of the profitability of Trump's key assets. He also has some partners that have to make disclosures too. And so we can get a lot of data through both the lenders and the partners. And also through local officials who are constantly looking at these properties and collecting data about them. And if you add up, you know, in each case, all right, so here's the profitability. If you have a building that's that profitable, here's the multiple that that would trade on. You know, we talked to a bunch of experts in each market in which Trump has investments. And then you also look at the actual structure itself. And you said, you know, here's how many square feet the building has. Here's roughly on a price per square foot built, you know, what a building would trade for in this particular market. And we just go through and we add them all up. And it's just a simple math equation. You know, you, once you figure out the value of the assets, you go through, you know, he owns about 30 sort of asset categories that we value. And, you know, we just go through each one, tally those up, and then we go through and we track all of the debt. Again, there's a lot of sort of speculation about his debt, and, you know, people think that it's impossible to know and we don't understand it. Truth is, we do have a pretty good handle on his debt. You know, Trump, a lot of his debt is packaged into commercial mortgage-backed securities. So there's a lot of information that investors need to understand about those buildings, about those loans. So we can track for many of his loans, you know, on a month-by-month basis, how much he owes on 40 Wall Street, on Trump Tower, on Trump International Hotel and Tower, so on and so on. And then he has mortgages that are recorded against many of these properties. So we know what those figures are. And same thing, you just go through one by one, figure out what the debt is, and then you tally it all up. And ultimately, you know, you get that $3.66 billion in assets, $1.1 billion in debt, and $2.5 billion net worth. Now, that's down significantly since he took office. And we can go into the reasons why he's lost so much money. But I think that when people, a lot of times people talk about, oh, Trump's gotten so rich on the presidency. Trump has tried to get rich on the presidency, but he's failed. He's not richer today than he was when he took office.
Mm. Dan Alexander is our guest. He's a senior editor at Forbes. His latest book is White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. So why did he lose money, net worth, as president?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. First, we'll start with sort of the effect of the presidency. You know, think about Donald Trump's brand. I mean, before he's a political figure, this is an aspirational brand. It stands for wealth. It stands for success. Now, when you hear the name Trump, it's immediately tied up in politics. And so for 50% of the country, that might be appealing. But for 50% of the country, that's really unappealing. And that means that you lose a lot of potential customers. So I'll give you just one example. If you look at Trump National Doral, his golf resort down in Miami. So that golf resort, you know, in 2015, the year that Trump announces that he's running for president, but frankly, before a lot of people are taking it very seriously, the golf resort is doing pretty well. You know, it's making, its revenues are about $92 million a year, and its net operating income is about $13 million and change. In 2016, now his presidential campaign is more serious. We're starting to see some of the effects of that change in what the brand is. The revenues fall to about $87 million. The profits fall to $12 million and change. In 2017, when Trump is in the Oval Office for the first time, the revenues fall to about $75 million. Remember, they were at $92 million 2 years before that. And the profits now are at $4.3 million. So that's a huge, huge decline. And the reason for the decline, and Trump's own tax representative said this in sworn testimony, that the reason for the decline is because of the polarization of his brand and that so many people don't want to be associated with it. You know, I spoke to somebody who's really familiar with the financials of that business, and they told me that after Trump won the presidency, they lost 100,000 booked room nights at Doral. This is a 643-room resort. So 100,000 booked room nights, I mean, that's the equivalent of like 5 months of fully booked business. And it's not just that, oh, if you're a Democrat, you don't want to go there. Think about it. This is a resort that hosts a lot of corporate events and corporate meetups and that sort of thing. Well, you know, if you're a Realtors Association, for example, are you going to invite hundreds of realtors to Doral when you know that now you might anger at least, 30% of them? If you decide to host it there, no, you're probably going to host it at the Hilton or something like that. You know, there are other options where to host things. And so that has really, really damaged a few of his properties, is the polarization of the brand. The other part of this equation is just that he hung on to tough assets. People were suggesting at the start of the presidency, all the ethics people said, you know, really what you should do is you should just divest and then take the proceeds from your divestment and put it in the S&P 500. Well, Trump would be far, far richer if he had done that, because he would be in, diversified investments that play in a lot of different industries. Instead, think about where he's invested. You know, he's got golf courses, which are doing okay, but are not, have never been a big growth investment. He's got hotels, which are really, really sucking wind right now, obviously, because of the coronavirus. And then he's got a bunch of commercial real estate, and that's in big, big trouble because, you know, every corporate tenant in America right now is rethinking the amount of office space that they are leasing. And so, sure, you might be able to hang on to the rents that you're getting this year. People might not be backing out of that, although certainly in some cases they are, but you're going to get a lot of that rent. But how about when their lease expires in 18 months? You know, and it's not that they're not going to have an office space. But think about it. If you shrink the total amount of office space that, you know, every commercial tenant in New York wants, if the demand for that goes down by even, say, 20%, that's a huge contraction. And it's just a supply and demand question. That means that then the people who own the real estate, like Donald Trump, can't charge as much money for the real estate. And so the value of those buildings, what somebody would pay to actually purchase it, to own that real estate, has taken a nosedive. And you can just look at the stock of publicly traded companies that own a lot of office space in New York. You know, look at Vornado's stock. I mean, it's way, way down since the pandemic hit. You know, technology companies have been doing just fine, and other parts of the economy have rallied. Commercial real estate took a hit and hasn't really recovered. And so Trump's sitting on this pile of assets that, you know, no one would have wanted to be in if they could see the future in 2017. But Trump decided to hang on to him anyways, despite the conflicts, and now he's saddled with a tough business.
What can you tell us about one of the mysteries, the enduring mysteries of the Trump business, his businesses? That is that because he went bankrupt several times, the lenders wouldn't lend to him. So the thinking is that he had to turn to Deutsche Bank or had to turn to Russian oligarchs to get money to borrow for his business to keep them afloat. What can you tell us about that?
So he has relied on Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank right now has loans of $340 million out to the President of the United States. It's a lot of money. But he's got $1.1 billion in loans. So most of his loans are not actually from Deutsche Bank. It's his largest creditor, but there's no one creditor that holds the majority of his debt. And, you know, I think that this idea that he had to go to, you know, Russian oligarchs to get loans, to put it bluntly, it's a conspiracy theory. I mean, there are questions to ask about money that's flowing into Trump's empire, and that it's always legitimate to ask questions and to keep hunting for more. What we know is that Trump has made sales of real estate. For instance, he sold a mansion down in Florida to a Russian oligarch for about $100 million. That's a large injection of cash, but that's not a loan, and it's not an amount that necessarily would leave you with continual leverage, you know, where somebody else would have continual leverage against you. Now, there are some questions about who holds all of Trump's debt today. We know most of it. Certainly we know who originated these loans. And, you know, they're standard financial institutions. In many cases, those loans have been chopped up and sold off. We don't always know who's bought the little bits of it once it's been sold off. But his loan portfolio is much less of a mystery than people tend to think it is. He does have a lot of debt. $1.1 billion is a lot of debt. But it's important to remember that he also has $3.66 billion in assets. And so if he, you know, when these loans come due, which many of them are coming due soon, and his business is not generating, you know, enough cash flow to pay off all of those loans with just cash flow. But, you know, he can refinance these loans, or he can sell properties. And then once he sells properties, then he can use the cash to pay down the loans. So he's got the assets to make out of this situation that he's in just fine. There are some questions about whether that will create additional conflicts, because then you're going to a bunch of Wall Street banks and you're basically saying, hey, will you lend me a couple $100 million? Oh, and by the way, I'm the President of the United States who's regulating your banks, many of which are under investigation and all of that. Same situation if you try to sell something for several $100 million. You know, hey, I want to sell the Washington, D.C. hotel. You know, the Trump Organization had put it up for sale. They took it off the market once the coronavirus hit. But, you know, they were listing a thing or throwing around numbers of like $500 million. Well, it's not worth anywhere near $500 million. And they weren't going to get that, and they probably knew that. But by putting out that price and offering for somebody to pay them $500 million, they were basically sending out a big, you know, invitation. Hey, if you want to pay the President of the United States hundreds of millions of dollars, including money that, you know, this asset's not worth, you know, here's a way to do it. And so those raise their own ethical concerns. But I do think that the concerns around his loans, it's fair for people to ask questions. They should keep asking questions. We'll keep, you know, digging about it. but to say, you know, with certainty that he's got a bunch of loans from Russia that are active, the evidence just isn't there. It's just people's speculation, and you've got to be very, very careful about speculating in these times. I think that people who criticize Trump a lot like to rail against Republicans for throwing out conspiracy theories. They should be careful not to do the same thing.
The book is White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. And the author, Dan Alexander, is with us. And this is WMNF in Tampa. Are there violations of the law or possible violations of the law in these businesses that are doing, or these countries, too, that are doing business with the president? Are there any possible red flags that you saw out there that might warrant investigation?
Well, look, the first law of the United States is the United States Constitution. And, you know, there are deals that certainly look to ethics experts like they're violations of the U.S. Constitution. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which basically bans the president from receiving payment from foreign governments while he's in office. And there's a lot of arguing about, you know, well, if something's a standard business transaction, you know, does that count as an emolument? And ethics experts are pretty united that, yes, it still does. But that's the argument that Trump's lawyers make, is that, no, it doesn't, and this is all standard business, and so it's not an Emoluments Clause violation. But, you know, I want to take you back to 555 California Street and that deal involving the Qataris. You know, if Qatar is renting office space, but they're not using the office space, and it doesn't seem like they need the office space, then that's not, as Trump's lawyers say, a value-for-value exchange. So their main defense, which, frankly, a lot of people have questions about whether it's a legitimate defense anyways, but their main defense then goes out the window. And so you have this situation where a foreign government is paying the president of the United States. The difference between, you know, this and handing a bag of cash to Donald Trump is that, you know, it flows through a bunch of business entities. But ultimately, this is his. And so if you have it flowing through shell companies or not, the money is still going to him. You know, there's other instances that are involving even more money. So, for instance, in Trump Tower, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China is renting space on the 20th floor. Now, you might remember that one of the promises that Trump and his team made at the beginning of the presidency was that they were going to take all of their profits from foreign governments and donate those back to the U.S. Treasury. This is a way of saying we're at least acknowledging, you know, that the Emoluments Clause exists, and we're going to take some steps to, you know, to note that. The problem is that if you look at the math, it just doesn't add up. It doesn't look like they're actually doing that. So in 2017 and 2018, you know, the Trump Organization donated about, I think it was $363,000 to the U.S. Treasury and said that those were its profits from foreign governments. But if you just look at that one deal inside Trump Tower, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, this is a state-owned bank. It's owned at least 70% by the government of China. And that bank was paying about $1.9 million in annual rent. Now, even if you say, okay, that's $1.9 million, let's only count the 70% that's attributable to the government of China, okay? And then if you say, well, but you have to take out the stuff that's not profit. So, you know, not all the rent is going to be profit. Well, in that building, the profit margins are about 42%. So even if you take that $1.9 million, yeah, take it over 2 years, so now we're at about 3.8, and you multiply it by 0.7 for the Chinese stake, and you multiply it by 0.42 for the profit margin, you're still at more than three times the amount of money that the Trump Organization paid to the U.S. Treasury in 2017 and 2018. So they're donating some money, but it doesn't look like they're donating what they promised they would. And, you know, that looks like a possible violation of the U.S. Constitution. So there are legal concerns about all of this, and there's ongoing litigation on the Emoluments Clause and various other things. But one thing that's important to remember is that litigation and the legal system in this country are very slow. And so just because Trump has not been punished for these things does not mean that what he's doing is legal. It just means that it's taking a long time to work its way through the courts. And we'll find out what the ultimate verdict is of this stuff. But these are serious questions, and there's a reason why they weren't thrown out of court right away. These things are still making their way through the courts.
Mm. Dan, thanks for spending all the time with us. Let me ask you one more question, and that is, There's been a lot of suggestion that the president is steering Secret Service agents, for instance, and others to use his resorts as places to stay. And when the Secret Service agents stay there, he charges them the top room rate, not the, the discount rate or anything like that. Same is true for, he suggested to his ambassador over in Scotland to steer the British Open to one of his golf courses. How big of a problem, at least in your book, did you find that this was, if at all?
Well, there's no question it's a problem. And, I think that probably the most blatant example of this is when Trump, pushed for the G7 conference to be held at Doral as golf resort in Miami. Ultimately, they backed off of that because there was such an uproar about it. But that's the sort of thing, the criminal conflicts of interest statute is a federal law that prohibits officials from doing anything in their public role that's going to clearly benefit their personal finances. Now, if anyone else in the executive branch of the government, other than the vice president or the president, had done that, that would be a criminal offense. And they would likely be convicted on that. The evidence was so clear. There is an exception in that law that it does not apply to the president or the vice president. And this is sort of the fundamental thing that you have to understand when you're scratching your head and saying, how does this happen? is that from a legal perspective, Trump is allowed to do that. He and Mike Pence are the only two people in the executive branch who are allowed to push business to their properties. And so it's not so much a legal question. It's more of an ethical question. Is this the right thing to do, particularly, if you're worried about government spending and proper management of the federal budget, when you are asking for millions of dollars or directing millions of dollars to go into your own businesses, is that a proper way to conduct yourself? And the ramifications for that, again, are not legal ones. They're potential electoral ones. The question is whether it's offensive to enough people that they eventually decide to vote him out, or whether they're okay with that and want to leave him in because they appreciate other policies that he puts in place.
Dan Alexander, thanks for coming on WMNF. Is there anything else that you'd like to raise, any other issue that I didn't raise that you'd like to point out about your book, White House Inc.?
Oh, boy. I mean, I could talk about Trump and his money and his businesses for hours. That's what happens when you spend a year investigating it. But that, that was a good overview. I think that one common misconception that I just sort of want to reiterate, we knew at the start of Trump's presidency, when he made this decision to hang on to his business, that this was going to be tough politically, that, the optics of this weren't necessarily going to be great. But what we didn't know was whether this would be a good business decision, whether he was going to make money on this or whether he was going to lose money on it, because nobody had ever tried anything like it before. And so it was really this experiment. What happens when you take a multi-billion dollar business and you bring it with you into the White House? And what we've seen over the last few years are the results of that experiment unfolding before our eyes, day by day, week by week, month by month. And the results are now in. This was, in fact, as we all could have guessed, a tough political move, that will have political ramifications for Trump because of the optics. What's perhaps more surprising is that this was also a bad business decision. He's lost a lot of money. And if he had just gotten out of everything and taken the presidency with clean hands, he would be both cleaner as a politician and richer as a businessman.
Dan Alexander, thanks for coming on WMNF. Great to have you here.
Sure thing. Thank you for having me.
Dan Alexander is a senior editor at Forbes, where he leads the magazine's coverage of Donald Trump. He's just written a new book called White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. And you're listening to 88.5 FM. Next up, we're going to talk with Joe Bonfilio, who is the president of the Environmental Defense Fund Action. And we're going to talk about the environment and the state of the environment over the last few years, especially in light of the vice president's comments the other night that the air and water in the U.S. is cleaner than it's ever been. Joe Bonfilio, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right, so you're part of the Environmental Defense Fund Action, and you're the president of that group. Tell me, first of all, what does your group do?
Yeah, I am. And EDF Action, as the short of it, is the advocacy and political arm of Environmental Defense Fund, a well-known 50-year-old environmental nonprofit. We really focus on getting policy change and pushing policy both in Congress and in key state legislatures across the country. That's what we do.
I was watching the vice presidential debate the other night. I'm sure you were too. And the vice president, Mike Pence, said that the air and water in the U.S. has never been cleaner in history. So I spent a lot of time outdoors. My eyebrows were raised slightly because I love the environment of the U.S. But when the vice president says that the air and the water in the country has never been cleaner, from your perspective, what do you think?
Well, it was a talking point that was flipped a little bit. He wasn't quite like his boss, which claims the U.S. has the cleanest air and water in the world. That's one we've heard really about a half a dozen times just in the last couple months as he has been campaigning. You know, the truth is, the U.S. is pretty good. It does rank pretty high in across the world. We have the 10th cleanest air and the 29th cleanest water. That's because we've had longstanding laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act that have been doing their job for decades. You know, they're passed under Republican presidents, Democratic presidents with huge bipartisan majorities. And, you know, we are doing pretty well because of them. Now, the funny thing here is the Trump administration has really leaned into undermining both those two bedrock laws, and it hasn't been a subtle effort. They worked to loosen some of the rules that keep toxic chemicals like benzene and mercury out of the air. They have loosened the rules so that these pollutants, among others, find their ways into really low-income communities and communities of color far more than those of white and sort of privileged urban areas. You know, he's worked to roll back the Clean Water Rule, which protects streams and wetlands. So this administration is actually doing everything it possibly can to drop further down that list. And if they're given another 4 years, I don't really think that the vice president will be able to say that. I think all told, the administration has tried to undo about 30 different clean air protections and just about a dozen clean water protections.
The president is really big on coal. If his policies were followed through on coal, what would happen to clean air in this country?
Well, the interesting thing that I think doesn't get any sort of time attention is that, yes, the president really tries to stress the supply side of this, right? That, you know, coal and mining more coal and coal jobs are critically important. But the administration and the president also is pushing the demand up. He's also in the same time doing things that increase the use of fossil fuels, increase the use of coal. And I think that's sort of the missing piece here. If we do not begin to retire and transition from coal, this country will drive more and more CO2 into the atmosphere, and we will not keep warming or climate change under the quote-unquote 2 degrees that we know we need to try to do as a planet in order for the worst impacts of climate change to not come to fruition. So coal in many ways is the dirtiest, the one fossil fuel that we know we must begin to wean ourselves off of. And if the president has his way, as he has been doing, the same clean air laws that I mentioned are also there or being weakened to allow for coal use into the future. These are all connected. And we simply can't do that if we're going to meet the climate crisis.
When it comes to clean water, when you burn coal, you have all this waste, this ash, coal ash. You have to store it on site. And a lot of times that stuff is stored right next to rivers and bays. And there's a danger that if the stuff gets out, it does tremendous damage to rivers and bays, right?
incredibly true. I grew up in North Carolina, and coal ash is a huge issue in North Carolina because they've had those ponds fail, and those ponds have moved into waterways, especially in rural areas where folks get their water from a well. So, which is one of those things that it is truly linked from climate change to local pollution impacts.
Well, we're talking with the president of the Environmental Defense Fund Action Group, and his name is Joe Bonfilio. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. The president has suggested that the Obama administration, he said that the Obama administration has gone too far in terms of auto emissions and auto mileage standards. What's the president doing about that? What did the Obama administration recommend, and what is the current president doing?
Yeah, so, it seems like a million years ago, but it really was just really towards the end of 2015, 2016, when the car manufacturers, both the U.S.-based companies and international car makers, and the Obama administration came up with new CAFE rules. CAFE rules are the rules that are both pollution and, of course, how much miles to the gallon targets that they were going to try to hit over the course of an extended period of time. Now, this is a carefully crafted effort, again, with the car companies there, because, when I went to buy a car, one of the biggest things I care about is, how good is the fuel economy? I drive two gasoline-powered cars, and I try to find the ones that have really good gas economy, just because, frankly, gas is expensive. Now, this was something that was moving forward, and really very early on in the administration, they took aim at these rules and began to sort of open up the question again, which created a massive amount of unease within the industry itself. You had some car companies saying, no, stick to the plan as we agreed upon with Obama, and you had a couple other car companies that went along with the Trump administration, frankly, because they were afraid of being a part of a targeted tweet from the president. And it has created this moment where car companies and, frankly, consumers aren't quite sure what's next. And as states like California push to go to an all-electric vehicle fleet by I believe it was like 2030, 2040 is what they're aiming for, you have just a sort of this disruption, which makes no sense. The only way it makes sense is if you're trying to drive up the demand for fossil fuels, which we know this president is trying to do.
Joe, is there any way to pick which industry is the worst polluter in the country, whether it comes to water pollution or air pollution? And I'm thinking of, we've got coal, we've got oil, we've got the conventional automobile manufacturers, the ones that don't produce electric cars or produce hybrid cars. We've got the fracking industry. We've got a lot of industries. Is there a way that your group has determined which industry contributes most to pollution in the country?
No, we haven't. And I would say that one of the reasons there is that within these industries, you have really good actors that are trying to transition to a cleaner economy. And then you have actors that are trying to hold on to the economies of the past, the industries of the past. Mm-hmm. And you have that within the power sector. You have that within the oil and gas sector. You have that within with companies that are a part of the fracking boom in this country. So it's a little bit all over the map. And that's the reason that we focus on pushing for policy that evens the playing field, policy that says that if you're doing this thing, it should be done with these protections in place. It is the one way we believe we can make the biggest change and set an even playing field for U.S.-based companies to compete in. It's worked for a really long time. To the first part of this interview, we were talking about the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. Certainly, the boom of the U.S. economy has not waned throughout the decades that those laws have been in place. Americans have innovated their way through them. So the short answer here is that policy really drives the most change, and then singling out one industry or the other is not all that helpful. We're going to be having coal-driven power for some time. We're going to be having oil and gas driving manufacturing and, of course, our vehicles for some time, too.
I want to ask you about Washington, D.C., because some of our listeners have worked in Washington. Some have never been there. They don't know what it's like as people lobby Congress. The president is famous for saying he wants to drain the swamp, and I think some people view that as, well, he wants to take the special interests out of Washington, D.C. And my question is, you're up there in D.C., you know what it's like. When you look at the lobbyists that work on behalf of fossil fuels that are still doing damage to the economy, and when you look at the environmental side, the side that's trying to clean up the air and clean up the water, who has more power? And do fossil fuel lobbyists have more power these days, more access to Congress, more access to the president's staff than during the time of the Obama administration?
So to your question about access, unequivocally, yes. The fossil fuel lobby has a direct line to the White House. It has a direct line to every important policy-making function of the administration. And I can say that unequivocally because, frankly, fossil fuel lobbyists run the departments and agencies that are in charge of regulating those industries. This is something that has been a hallmark of the Trump presidency. Especially when you take a look at the folks that run EPA, the folks that run Department of Energy, among others. They are simply the fossil fuel lobbyists that were lobbyists 5 minutes ago are now running these departments.
So you're saying hasn't drained the swamp, that the swamp really is still there and has taken over the bureaucracy under the Trump administration?
Your folks, your listeners, know about some swamps. I'm just saying that the swamp creatures moved into fancier offices in this case, and they're working on behalf of those interests, and they're doing so under the guise of a office that should be taking care of America and the American people, not their old bosses.
There's a big debate. Some of the more progressive members of Congress have what's called the Green New Deal. Vice President Biden is not a fan. He says he doesn't want it, although I think he supports parts of it. But I'm wondering about jobs. If you have a more environmentally friendly economy, does that mean that you're going to do away with a lot of blue-collar jobs and that those people that formerly worked in construction and carpentry and electrical, are those jobs for those kind of people going to disappear if we transform to a more green economy?
I actually argue that the amount of blue-collar jobs, trades jobs, building trades jobs, only go up. And, you know, this is just a small example. We put solar panels on our home right outside here in Washington, D.C., and it was a construction crew and an electrical crew that came and installed those panels. It was not a white-collar desk job. There was a crew of about 10 people that worked over the course of 2 days to do that just on my home. I have a small little home right out here, right outside D.C. At scale, a clean energy transition creates jobs in this country. We know this to be true. There are states like California and even North Carolina that have seen a huge jump in the clean energy industry and are employing hundreds of thousands of people because of it. There are far more people employed by clean energy industry right now than are employed in the coal industry. That's just a fact. And a transition that speeds that along means that those jobs begin to pop up in states everywhere. And this country, the United States, is the dominant player in a world economy that is going to be moving towards clean energy over the course of the next couple decades. That is actually the future, and one that I'm really excited about. And I think that environmentalists very much are for those jobs and would cheer policy that drives that forward.
I don't know what the Environmental Defense Fund Action Group, what your position is on the Green New Deal, so I'll ask that in the context of this question. So if we do some sort of environmental program that reduces greenhouse gases and it costs money, I think the opponents say, look, it's going to cost billions and hundreds of billions of dollars, and we'll never get that money back, and the money just disappears, and we'll go deeply into debt, and it doesn't benefit the economy in a net way. Anyway, what's the EDF position on the Green New Deal, and does the money just disappear once you spend it?
Two great questions. So the first is simple and straightforward. We did not endorse the Green New Deal. We supported a piece of legislation called 100% Clean that was introduced in the House last year. And
well, that's my interview with Joe Bonfilio, who is the president of the Environmental Defense Fund Action Group, and we've been talking about the environment. Unfortunately, I won't be able to play the entire interview. Thanks to Barbara Fling. She's been our phone producer today. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can call us up on our comment line, 813-238-8001. Record your comment on